and welcome to episode 6 of Investigating the Post Office Scandal. My name is Rebecca Thompson, author of the first published investigation about the Post Office's Horizon IT system when I worked for Computer Weekly in 2009.
And I'm Nick Wallace, author of the book The Great Post Office Scandal, and as you might be able to tell, I'm not very well, which means you're not going to hear much from me this episode.
So tell everyone why you're ill.
I don't know why I'm ill. I know that I got ill on the train up to Manchester because I was doing a presentation of Post Office Scandal, the inside story, as part of the Refract Festival at the Waterside Arts Centre in Sale. And as I was sitting on the train, I started to feel quite rotten and then started sneezing, which was great for everyone on the train. I've tested negative for COVID, you'll be pleased to know, but whilst I got through the presentation okay, immediately afterwards I just got even worse, and I've been horrendous ever since. So forgive me if I'm coughing and sneezing and sounding very boggy throughout my contribution to this episode. As I say, I'll try and keep my contribution to a minimum so as not to annoy people.
It doesn't sound like man flu. At first I just assumed
Well, at least it's not COVID. That's one thing I can say. And I'm surrounded by drugs and tissues, which will hopefully help. But my nose is tingling, and so I may sneeze. So you better get on with what you have to say, and I'll just try and, although I don't know, I'll hide under the desk if I need to make a noise or cough or interrupt. I'm sorry.
So it meant that you couldn't come along to the Court of Appeal?
No, I'm really sorry about that. Yes, I ought to apologise, because yes, you and I were going to go to the Court of Appeal to see 5 more convictions quashed, and you had to do it on your own.
Yes, I went along. I saw those 5 more convictions being overturned, which brings the total to 81. Only one of the postmasters present, Richard Hawkes, wanted to speak to the press, and so I caught up with him briefly outside the court after the hearing.
Well, from the inception, when finding discrepancies, which I admit hiding, to the date in October, I think it was 2004, when I called in the post office auditors because I had this discrepancy, and they came down. I had to shut up shop straight away, and it never opened again. And they had their investigators there, 2 of them, and they asked all these questions of you about the money shortage, etc., which you've really got no idea. Well, I had no idea, pretty well. And the fact I made a mistake in telling them I kept a record of all these discrepancies. Oh, can we see it? I showed them, and then they said, right, we're keeping that. You'll not get that back. That was my only record I had. I should have kept my mouth shut, and then at least I would have had something tangible to hold. But I had no details at all. It's all on memory.
And how much was it that they were?
Over 11,000, which it was at just that the judge stated that at sentencing, if the money wasn't paid into court, it would be a case of fraud and probable imprisonment. So my brother found the money for me, and it was paid in on the day of the judgment, and I avoided that and just got community service instead. And it's taken me since 2005 to earlier this year before I'd be able to pay my brother back, because years have been without work or very low paid work. It just wasn't possible. Mortgage I should have paid off before now, it's still not paid off. So it does have a ripple effect. About the best thing that we've managed to do in that time is keep the roof over our heads. And we've got some very good neighbours and friends in the village, which have been your support network. So I've been very lucky in that respect, because they've not believed it, now they're going to be proved right, which is brilliant.
And what's next for you now? You're planning a compensation claim, and
that'll be next. They'll be contacting me to start sorting out what needs to go into the claim and what doesn't, and how long that'll take, who knows.
But a huge relief today
when the judge mentioned your name and said it's gone. You could feel like this cold shiver going down from working from your shoulders down your body, and it's such a wonderful feeling. And the fact that your brain is not going to be mulling over the ifs and buts of what you've gone through all this time, that is going to, there's going to be room in there for other things now. So yeah, gorgeous, absolutely.
That's Richard Hawkes, who's just had his conviction overturned. Thank you very much to Richard for speaking to us. We're very grateful.
And I'm very sorry, Rebecca, that I couldn't be there. But I noticed that you've written a newsletter about this already, and your reporting has been picked up by Professor Richard Moorhead of Exeter University. By the way, if you want to subscribe to Rebecca's Substack newsletter, it's currently free, isn't it, Rebecca?
It is, yes.
It is. So how do you find it? Do you just Google your name and newsletter?
I guess Google my name and Substack newsletter. It's literally called Rebecca Thompson's newsletter. It's not very...
There you go, Rebecca Thompson's newsletter. Well, I'm a subscriber, and I saw your report, which was brilliant because, as I said, I couldn't be there. But it was also picked up by Professor Richard Moorhead of Exeter University, a very well-renowned and respected legal ethics blogger who himself has written something about the quashing of the convictions on Monday on his own Substack newsletter, which has an element of serendipity about it because he's our next interviewee in this episode.
He is. So I actually spoke to Professor Moorhead a couple of weeks ago. I think it was before the compensation hearing started. So he, along with his colleagues, Hannah Noakes and Rebecca Helm, he runs the Post Office Project at the Evidence-Based Justice Lab at Exeter University. They're researching a range of topics relating to the scandal, mostly surrounding how it happened and the impact on people affected. I started by asking him whether he thinks, in the light of what we now know, there should be an investigation into whether or not anyone at the Post Office perverted the course of justice, a proposition which has already been floated as a potential course of action by Flora Page and Paul Marshall, two barristers representing some of the sub-postmasters. And this is what he had to say.
I mean, I think there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that the issues around perverting the course of justice do need investigating. You've got basically at least three sort of different sets of clusters of problems. So you've got all the problems around the initial prosecution of the sub-postmasters, the suggestion that evidence may have been given by witnesses that was misleading. So the two Fujitsu witnesses who we think have been investigated by the interviewed by the police, for instance. You've got the Post Office's general approach to disclosure, which was to refuse to engage unless sub-postmasters provided dates and times, which they weren't in a position to, and a refusal to disclose unless defendants paid for it. So there's sort of refusing disclosure in blanket terms or for bad reasons. And you have specific failures to disclose, like the failure to disclose information that came to light just before Seema Misra's trial. So, as I'm sure you've been told already, there was a meeting between Post Office and Fujitsu staff which showed significant problems with bugs, showed that there could be remote access to Horizon. Report of that meeting landed in the Post Office lawyers' inboxes literally a day or two before Seema Misra's trial, a trial which they knew was sort of fundamental to the defence of Horizon and was being portrayed as such and seen as a full frontal attack on Horizon, and yet that report doesn't get disclosed to Seema Lawyer's defence team. And there are a couple of other examples, not quite as bad as that, but a bit like that. So there's a whole bunch of stuff around the initial prosecutions, also the general policy of, and it does seem to have been a policy, of telling sub-postmasters they were the only ones who were suffering Horizon problems. All of those various strands point to potentially to deliberate attempts to conceal or divert the course of justice in ways which may have been either reckless or intentional and therefore potentially a crime. There are those three big phases, and you could argue even a fourth in relation to the appeal hearing.
Yeah, and the defence of privilege, do you think that that would stand up in any way?
It's not a defence, it's a protection against revealing evidence. In normal circumstances, if a client gives a lawyer information and a lawyer gives client advice, both that information and the advice is privileged. You can't require it to be disclosed. There are exceptions to that. So the professional regulator for solicitors, for instance, can reach behind that to see if the solicitor has engaged in misconduct. And if there is reasonable evidence that there may have been crime or fraud, so crime or serious wrongdoing, if you like, privilege won't apply. And as you'll know, in relation to the inquiry, Post Office and others have largely agreed to the waiver of privilege. There's a sort of time limit on it. So things will come out in the inquiry which wouldn't have ordinarily done so.
Okay. Brilliant. So I'll move on to your work, which I'm really excited to learn more about. So first of all, I wondered if you could just sort of tell me what your role is and what your role more broadly is.
So I'm an academic who looks essentially at lawyers and legal services, and I tend to concentrate on looking at the professional conduct of lawyers. Have they behaved appropriately? Have they behaved ethically or legally? And also the regulatory apparatus around trying to ensure that. I'm part of a team with Dr. Karen Noakes at UCL and Dr. Rebecca Helm, a colleague of mine at Exeter, who have been working on the Post Office scandal for some time now. And we're looking at partly at trying to understand what the nature of the conduct by the lawyers. So what did the lawyers do? What might have influenced their behaviour? Might they have done things wrong? And that's what we've been basically concentrating on in our work so far. So you'll have seen on the website, the Evidence-Based Justice Lab website, we produced some papers essentially discussing the conduct of the lawyers. And we produced one submission, which we haven't published, which we put into the inquiry on the criminal conduct. So if you like, phases, the middle phase of the three phases I was just talking about a minute ago. We're also interested in, and this is Rebecca Helm's interest in particular, as well as mine, in the workings of the criminal justice system. So Rebecca does a lot of work on plea bargaining, if you like, and obviously one of the big strands of the Post Office story was the pressure that sub-postmasters were put under in relation to their prosecutions. So the pressure to plead guilty, the pressure to seek mitigation on a restricted basis, and so on. So those two elements are the strongest elements. We're also interested in the impact on sub-postmasters and mistresses and their colleagues in terms of the impact on their lives, mental health impacts of being accused, being prosecuted, convicted, exonerated. So we're doing a little piece of work around that at the minute to see if we might be able to investigate that in a bit more depth. So for instance, what has the impact been of being exonerated on those that have now been exonerated in the Court of Appeal, for instance? So the whole range of things around those kinds of topics.
Brilliant. Broadly, when did the work start, and what was it about this particular case that interested you as a group so much?
I can't remember. I can't remember when we started exactly. It would have probably been around the time of the Hamilton case. I mean, I'd been aware of it for a little while and started to follow it. It was when I really started to read the Bates judgments and understand the depth of concerns that the judge expresses there about what's been going on. That's when we started to talk about doing some more work on it. And then the Hamilton case, of course, added very significantly to that. So it was around that somewhere around the time of the end of Bates and the beginning of the Hamilton case.
And in terms, I mean, obviously the work is ongoing. I'm guessing it will be ongoing for a long time yet. But in terms yep. of what you're starting to find and what you're, any, I don't want to say conclusions exactly, but the kind of things that you're starting to explore and discover, are you able to give me any sense of the type of things that are coming up?
We've mainly concentrated on what's the kind of prima facie, the basic concerns that are raised by the judgments and the evidence emerging around those judgments. So trying to shine a light on the ways in which the lawyers and their lawyers' interactions with the business, if you like, the post office, how they may have either been a central part of it or an important part of the problem. And we've found a whole raft of those, and we're able to, if you like, shine a real light on the centrality of the lawyer's behaviour to the problem. So we've kind of, in a way, we've sort of shifted from thinking about the post office scandal as an IT scandal to now being seen as a corporate governance and bad lawyering scandal potentially. And the main outcome of that, I suppose, is that the inquiry recognised early on that it needed to look more strongly at corporate governance and look at the lawyering and get privilege lifted. So it's had that kind of practical influence. I wouldn't say it was just us, because there were other people making similar points in the end, but that's the principal overarching thing. I suppose the other thing I would say is, if you stand back and you look at the picture as a whole, what we see is problems with lawyering and lawyers' relationships to commercial organisations, which are significant and obviously lead to terrible consequences in this case, but occurred over a long period of time repeatedly. So we're not talking about one or two isolated incidences, somebody having a rush of blood or a moment of madness. We're talking about a concerted approach to the management of legal risk, the management of debt, if you like, or the management of problems with the software, which shifted all that risk to sub-postmasters and post office employees, shifted the risk onto the little people, if you like, and then enforced that risk in ways which were oppressive, and did so over a very long period of time, culminating in what has a good deal of the flavour of and may well become seen as a cover-up. So you've got a concerted patterns of behaviour by different lawyers at different periods of time over a long period, which suggests a much more general problem than, if you like, one or two bad apples.
Yeah. And just to give me a sense of those patterns of bad behaviour, can you give me any quick examples?
So the ways in which the contracts were handled with the sub-postmaster, so it was a chaotic, bureaucratic, ridiculous procedure, really, totally inadequate in legal terms, which post office and its lawyers then relied upon oppressively. So they threatened post office workers, sub-postmasters, sub-postmistresses with debt, litigation, termination of contracts when they shouldn't have been doing so, on the basis of evidence which was either non-existent or too weak. So they are basically using corporate and legal power inappropriately to force the sub-postmasters, sub-postmistresses to pay up money that they didn't owe. And then, in a similar vein, without proper evidence, sometimes with contrary evidence, proceeding to prosecute them when they shouldn't have been prosecuting them, and prosecuting them in ways which were both aggressive and oppressive. So being inappropriately aggressive in their strategies for dealing with sub-postmasters, sub-postmistresses when they're prosecuting them. So there's those kind of two elements. Then the third element is the phase when they come under pressure to reveal what's going on, and they go into defensive mode, say there's nothing to see here, when there is actually an absolute massive evidence to see, which is very, very deeply concerning. They are telling Parliament there is no evidence of miscarriages of justice. They are resisting CCRC's suggestions that appeals should be brought forward, it seems, and they are not disclosing evidence which they should be. So the lawyers, if you like, with the business, or the business and the lawyers, or the business, and it's not quite clear who's leading the process here, are stonewalling or covering up really serious impropriety, really serious problems with the prosecutions when they should not be, and they are not behaving independently or appropriately. So there's those kind of three elements to it.
Do you have any sense of why or how this kind of behaviour develops?
Yes, we do. I mean, there's quite so my colleague Karen Noakes and I are particularly interested in that dimension of it. And there's a sort of is it a bad apples or is it a bad barrels question? So is it the culture, the structures that are corrupt or problematic? Is it the individuals that are doing bad things when they shouldn't?
And how does that culture develop if it is the culture?
Well, so, I mean, it's a really interesting question, isn't it? So if you stand back, you can sort of point to a number of things. So you can have the sort of general drift towards trying to make the post office more commercial. You have what the psychologists call confirmation bias and associated problems. So once you've taken a decision, so once you've formed the view that some postmasters are dishonest, for instance, it becomes quite hard to resile from that view. And it's particularly difficult if you have something like a computer system, which if you start to doubt it, opens up a bit of a black hole in terms of what you can and can't rely upon. So they have lots of psychological reasons for, if you like, closing their mind to the evidence of problems in the Horizon system and for allying themselves with the sort of post office line, if you like. And you see it sometimes explicitly. So there's one period where Paula Vennell says, and it's about remote access to Horizon, it's about whether or not people can change data in the Horizon system, with whether the engineers can do it remotely. And she says, and they're asked, can you do it? And Paula Vennell says, I need to be able to say no to this.
Yeah.
And people sort of fall around trying to find a way of saying no in a way which isn't misleading, when actually the answer is yes, they can do it. So there's that kind of filtering down of, if you like, the kind of Thomas A. Becket problem, who will rid me of this turbulent priest problem. The other thing is that lawyers have for some time been under pressure to be commercial and to be aligned to the business, and some of that's sort of sensible and a good thing, but it kind of pushes them into areas where they discount legal problems or don't deal with evidence and legal questions independently and objectively. So there's quite a lot of evidence around how individuals can, if you like, just become biased by the very fact that they want to help, they need to help this particular client. So there's a whole bunch of sort of structural influences which might provide an excuse, if you like, for some of the individuals involved. They might be able to say, well, actually, we just didn't see it this way at the time. This is how we saw it. We saw ourselves as doing a good job for the post office. I think the problem with that is the level of both the nature of the conduct and its consequences. So the fact that people were going to prison is something which should ordinarily make people sit up and take notice of, actually be more careful in their thinking. But also the fact that these problems kept repeating. We were talking about 20 years, the problems kept coming back, and there were opportunities to review the situation. So Simon Clark's famous advice is in 2013, where, if you like, the balloon goes up, and Clark basically says, you've got a really big problem with all your prosecutions. And rather than that being a point of proper reflection where they stand back and say, OK, we need to sort this out, actually what they do is they double down. And mysteriously, over the coming year, the prosecutions are reviewed and very little, if any, disclosure is made. There are repeated opportunities to sort of say, hang on a minute, and the litigation, the Bates litigation would be another one. Hang on a minute, we may have got this wrong. And what the post office and their lawyers do is, rather than say, yeah, actually, we've made a mistake here, they're locked into their previous strategy and just carry on. That digs them deeper and deeper into a hole.
I can't imagine what it must have been like to continually not admit that mistake. I can't wrap my head around what that must have felt like on that side to keep digging that hole deeper and deeper.
I mean, the psychologists say we have ways of, they call it a sort of cognitive dissonance, of just discounting the things that we don't want to believe. We could just sort of close our minds to them.
Yeah.
And not notice them or not give them due weight. So yeah, there's that kind of process going on.
Okay, yeah, no, that's interesting. How common do you think this type of problem is in the legal profession? obviously this level is probably unique, but do you think these kind of problems are widespread or common?
Yeah, no, it's a really, I get asked this question a lot. It's a really interesting question. I think that it's quite common for lawyers to come under both direct and indirect pressure, if you like, to toe the corporate line. So I did some research with Stephen Vaughan and Christina Godinho a while back, where we tried to measure that within in-house communities. And we saw fairly high levels of people saying they did sometimes come under pressure to do things which were questionable. And I can certainly point to quite a large number of other examples of similar kinds of problems, not generally with people going to prison, but similar kinds of problems where lawyers have just expediently acted in the interests of short-term interests of their client or who they perceive their client to be, usually a powerful figure within an organisation. So there's lots of examples. I don't think that would necessarily mean that it's common, but it happens often enough for it to be a significant worry, for it to be a significant problem.
And do you think something needs to happen within the legal industry to encourage more of an independent approach, like a more independent thought?
Yeah, I absolutely do. It's very clear talking to lawyers themselves. So one of the good things about the Post Office scandal, and there aren't very many, but one of the good things is it has caused a good many, I won't say the majority, but a good many lawyers to stand back and think a bit about what they themselves have experienced. And I've been approached and talked to lawyers about their own experiences. I think there is a need for lawyers, particularly working in-house, but also working in commercial practice generally. And the Post Office scandal has involved firms of solicitors and has involved barristers in private practice. Both groups need to think about what independence means and how their judgment can be affected by client loyalties. And that might mean particularly in-house lawyers thinking a bit harder about how their work is structured within the organisations. And it may mean the regulators need to think about how they regulate commercial lawyers in particularly and in-house lawyers more specifically. So are they sufficiently robust around independence and those kinds of issues? So I think there's that side of it. I think the courts also need to think a bit about what they're doing. There's the sort of general concern about the criminal justice system revealed by the Court of Appeals judgment, revealed by the history of the criminal justice cases. But there's also the sense that if you look at commercial litigation cases, you quite often see judges giving lawyers slaps on the wrist for poor behaviour, but we don't often see that leading to something more serious. So I think there is a general problem about conduct in civil litigation. Some of it's kind of incivility, some of it may be unethicality, some of it may be incompetence, but there is a sort of bit of a general problem there. So there are a bunch of areas where the regulators and those responsible, as well as the firms and the companies themselves, need to think about improving things. So yeah, there's quite a lot of work to be done there, I think.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. The other thing that I wanted to ask about, and again, it might not be something that you've looked at, is I'm really interested in the racial splits between, first of all, who was prosecuted in the first place, and second of all, how they were treated by the criminal justice system. I don't know if this is something that you've looked at all.
So we have had a bit of a look. There isn't very good information, and we're trying to work out if there are ways of compiling better information as part of the research we're doing. We had a look at a sort of a sub-sample of cases where we did have some sentencing data, and that did suggest there might be some differences in sentences for black and minority ethnic sub-postmasters compared to white sub-postmasters, but it was a pretty crude comparison, so I wouldn't put a great deal of weight on it as revealing anything yet. There are a number of questions, so if you read the cases, there is a bit of a sense, but I haven't been able to properly measure the evidence yet, if you like, there is a bit of a sense that black and minority ethnic sub-postmasters and mistresses may have got from the stage of horizon problems to termination more quickly than white sub-postmasters and sub-postmistresses. So certainly some of the some of the black minority ethnics of postmasters, mistresses, seem to go quite quickly from shortfall problems to audit to termination, whereas the process seems to be a bit more protracted for at least some of the whites of postmasters. So that might suggest a different approach by post office when they were dealing with that. And general work on the criminal justice system, as I'm sure you'll have sort of picked up from the Lammy report and so on and so forth, but also academic work going back a long time, does suggest, judges hate to hear this, but does suggest that there may be differential treatment for people of colour in the criminal justice system. So they get more serious charges, they get more serious sentences, even taking account of those charges and so on and so forth. So it wouldn't be surprising if those problems were reflected in the post office case either, but the evidence is sort of too dispersed at this stage to say anything very concrete.
Yeah, it's very tricky. I thought it was I think it's Hudgel's submission to the compensation hearing next week.
Yeah.
They mentioned three postmasters that the post office is basically refusing to pay any compensation, and they are all BAME. Obviously, that's very small, but I just thought it was interesting. And I feel like it's an angle that needs a lot of work. I feel like there's definitely something there.
Yeah, no, I think it is. It's something we would certainly like to look into in more detail, and we're just trying to work out if there are ways of getting the data in a more organised way. And it would be interesting to know if the inquiry is actually thinking of doing anything like that, because it could be quite valuable. But it is quite a time-consuming process if you have to build up a database manually on that sort of stuff.
Yeah, which is what I've been doing, and it's extremely time-consuming.
Oh, have you? Okay. Well, maybe
I've not got very far because of the time-consumingness. That's one of I've tried an FOI to the post office, and actually one person, I can't remember his name now, I think one of the postmasters sent in an FOI that was more successful than mine. So the post office is only acknowledging that 400 and something prosecutions were related to Horizon, whereas I think the number that gets reported in the press is 700 plus. But anyway, they say of those 400, over 100, they don't know the ethnicity of the postmasters. And of the rest, a quarter of them were BAME, which is, it's only a small amount of the total picture, but it's still interesting to know that figure. And so I guess what would be interesting is to compare that to the total number of postmasters who are BAME across the entire estate.
Yeah, exactly.
So that's what I've asked for now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you could imagine that they might behave differently when they're confronted. So the three the Hudgels people that you mentioned, I think the post office have said, while there was confession evidence, even though they've been granted their appeals, they confessed. And I think the Court of Appeal said, I can't remember now exactly, but I think the Court of Appeal said, well, the confessions were based on effectively improper positions being put to them on Horizon. So they were being told there were debts which actually weren't there, and they confessed to false accounting or whatever on that basis. You can imagine why BAME clients might be more inclined to sort of give in at that point, if you like. It might be more respectful or whatever. So there are a whole bunch of interesting dynamics at work. It is one of the worrying elements, and it would be good to
understand more,
to push it further.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you so much. It's so fascinating hearing about your work and speaking to you about the whole case. I really appreciate your time, so thank you.
Not at all, Rebecca. Good luck to you with the podcast.
Thank you so much, Richard.
Thank you to Richard for his time. And just to bring us up to date, Nick, you want to alert us to what Professor Moorhead wrote in his newsletter about the convictions on the 25th of July.
Yeah, so Professor Richard Moorhead does a legal blog, but he's I think so taken by what's been happening at the post office, he's created an offshoot newsletter blog post, which you can subscribe to again on Substack. I guess you just search Richard Moorhead post office Substack or something. But this one's entitled "The Darkness Just Got a Bit Darker," and he's very polite about what you reported, and says that you've revealed something rather important. One of the victims who had their convictions quashed on Monday pleaded guilty in 2013 and evidence from Gareth Jenkins was used. Now, Gareth Jenkins was the former Fujitsu engineer, and the court heard that he had not reviewed the logs and data specific to the case in which he gave evidence, but nonetheless stated that Horizon records showing losses were accurate. And as Professor Moorhead states, 2013 was the year Simon Clark advised the post office that Gareth Jenkins' evidence was unreliable and should not be relied on. He also, Professor Moorhead, points out that Hudgell's solicitors, in their press statement about yesterday, I think Hudgell's, correct me if I'm wrong, Rebecca, they represented every single one of the five appellants on Monday.
They did, yeah.
Is that right? Yeah. So they've said, in documents disclosed as part of another appellant's appeal against his conviction, emails were unearthed which showed concerns were raised over the reliability of the Horizon system by legal representatives of Fujitsu, the company which manufactured the Horizon system. Now, I have never come across anything like this before. And Professor Moorhead says, I don't recall seeing anything which shows Fujitsu's involvement other than through witnesses like Gareth Jenkins. Fujitsu raising concerns adds to the roll call of matters occurring, particularly in 2013, although we don't know when Fujitsu raised their concerns, which points towards extensive, significant and senior knowledge of Horizon problems. So if you want to read more about what Professor Moorhead has pulled together in his blog, do subscribe to him. But it is really, really interesting that just in what I imagine was a fairly short appeal hearing yesterday, a lot of information has come to light, which I think will get the legal community scratching its heads once more.
Yeah, so hopefully all of these details, sort of interesting things coming up during that short hearing will be covered in the inquiry when it restarts in September at some point.
Yes, and I would hope that the Metropolitan Police, who are currently investigating two Fujitsu engineers and have been for the last 2.5 years, will also pick up on what came out of the Court of Appeal on Monday as being potentially of interest to their inquiries.
Yes, well, thank you so much to both of my interviewees for this episode, Richards, Moorhead and Hawkes, and congratulations to all five of the sub-postmasters who had their convictions quashed on Monday.
And congratulations as well to Nalini Joshi, who got her conviction at Southwark Crown Court quashed on Friday last week. So that brings, as you said earlier, Rebecca, the total to 81 from a total of 122 appeals, which have already been heard in the context of more than 600, which the post office think could be unsafe. And I'd just also like to thank Kevin and Sharon Brown. Sharon is a former sub-postmaster and a member of the 555 litigants at the civil court, who travelled all the way from Sunderland to Sale on Sunday in order to come up on stage and talk about, well, Kevin came up on stage, Sharon spoke from the audience because she was too shy to be on stage, but they both spoke incredibly movingly about their experience. And there was another sub-postmaster present who's got a claim in with the historical shortfall scheme. And he also gave a very powerful contribution from the floor. So it was worthwhile going, even though I got a horrendous cold as a result of my trip up north. Mm-hmm. I need to build some more resilience into my immune system for future visits to Manchester.
Brilliant. Okay, well, that is it for this week. Thank you so much for listening to Investigating the Post Office Scandal.
This podcast is researched, produced, edited, presented, paid for and owned by Rebecca Thompson and Nick Wallace.
We are kindly supported by Whistledown Productions, who are very nice and helpful.
They are indeed. We'll see you next time.
Bye.
Goodbye.